listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Much, Mark, for joining us today. I really enjoyed both your books, The Road to Winter and Wilder Country. Let's kick off by talking about some breaking news you have concerning Wilder Country.
Wilder Country's been lucky enough to have been awarded the Australian Indie Book Award for YA for 2018, which is fantastic. It was an incredible shortlist with Simone Howe and Fiona Wood and Kath Crowley, and there's Kate O'Donnell and Claire Christian as well, my mate and fellow texter. It's incredibly honoured just to be shortlisted with those writers, but to win the award is an awesome opportunity.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible and well-deserved because it is a novel that has resonated with so many people. What were your thoughts when you first heard that you'd won?
over the moon, of course. The Road to Winter was shortlisted for a number of awards, so it's kind of strange. Oh, it's not strange. It's great when you get shortlisted. But to be honest, you don't really expect to win because you see the company that you are that you're on the shortlist with. And like I said, I'm incredibly honoured with those writers to be in their company, number one, but then to be awarded the prize. So I was over the moon, and it's great for the book, obviously, in terms of, you know, promotion and sales. But I'm really linking it strongly with this. I've become a real ambassador for boys reading, and these two books are two books that have worked quite well for teenage boys. And I hope that it gives it sort of a kick along in that direction as well.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you're absolutely right about improving literacy for all teenagers, but especially boys, because as we know, their literacy and their reading and their interest in reading is dropping off. So that's a real win for you and for readers and for a young adult as well. And the caliber of people you are pit against, that must be amazing.
When you get on a short list, you know that you're up against some of the best. You're generally up against some of the best YA writers in Australia. And I'm pretty much a newbie, you know. I've only been in this game for a couple of years. I've only got two books out, and to be on those sort of shortlists is fantastic, but to get up and actually win a prize is amazing.
And like you said, it's going to do so much more, hopefully. It's going to really embrace the readers who've really resonated with.
Yeah, and I love the fact that it's voted on by indie booksellers as well. And I know my local indie bookstore down here is in Eyre's Inlet in Victoria on the West Coast. It's just this little oasis of sanity at times. And I know I can go in there. I know I'm going to get, I'm going to get a personal conversation and about what books are, you know, my local bookseller, name's Nicole. You know, I walk in there and she just says, "Here's your next book." I don't even have to browse the shelves. And I love the fact that there are still, even in this digital age, there are still, you know, shops like that that are part of the community and where you get that sort of personalised attention. And they also, they're fantastic supporters of Australian writers. I sort of look at them as the coalface of the publishing industry, because for all of their writing and proofreading and the editing and the distribution, I love the fact that there are people out there who are hand-selling these books and supporting Australian writers the way they do.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And there's nothing better than indie bookstore. I make it my business whenever I go anywhere around the world or in Australia to find those little quirky bookshops that are not a franchise and go and have a look, because they are really interesting places.
I'm glad it's not just me then that does that. My wife knows if there's a bookstore somewhere, that's where she'll find me.
That's right. It's a pretty good place to be. The reading and the writing community seems to be such a supportive community. And you said you're up against all these other amazing, incredible authors. It's such an incredibly supportive community.
It is very supportive. And, you know, I know that those other writers on the shortlist, I know they'll be disappointed, but they'll also be the first people to congratulate me. Because it's like becoming part of this family. And I know that sounds cliche, but it is. And we do a lot of touring together. We do end up at the same festivals together. We end up on shortlists together. And all of us, I think, are quite happy to spread those sorts of things around. And I have a great joke with Kath Crowley's a good mate, and, you know, She seemed to scoop the pool last year, and I sort of jokingly tweeted her and said, "Okay, time to let other people have a go now." So maybe she has stepped aside for this year. I don't know.
Well, congratulations. That is an amazing achievement and well-deserved. Had students read the book, and it's always been something that they've wanted to really talk to me about. I think actually you messaged one of my students after they messaged you, and she was just stoked. She still talks about it.
It's funny, the little, you do make those extraordinary connections at times with readers who find you through social media, and they've done projects on the book, or that, you know, and they just want to have that little point of connection. And it is one of the most amazing things about being an author, is that story that only existed in your head a couple of years ago is now being shared by people, you know, in this case, all around the world. So that's an amazing feeling.
Absolutely. And I think authors being so willing to speak to students and just have a quick little chat with them absolutely made her day and made her really want to continue reading the series. You were the only author who replied back to her out of all the other kids, so she felt like a star.
I've been in education my entire life, and there are lots of things that you judge success of a book by, but for me it is that sort of thing. It's that sort of engagement with students. It's seeing that book being taken on and taught in schools as part of curriculum, and I can't ask for anything more than that. That's fantastic.
Absolutely. Well, once again, congratulations. It's very well deserved. It was also really lovely to read a dystopian novel from an Australian author. And one aspect I always find with Australian literature is the strong reference to nature, both in a restorative sense when Finn needs to surf when he's feeling a bit stressed, and later winter becomes their protection from the wilders. Were you inspired by natural elements that appear as a motif in the books?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, the weather stuff is a real reference to, you know, this is a dystopian world, and where a virus has wiped out most of the population, but it's been assisted by climate change, and that's, you know, we make reference to that through both books. And the actual idea, you know, that came to me when I was writing the book, especially the first one, was that what would happen to the natural environment once human beings were largely taken out of it. And we see that with, you know, this little town where nature is actually reclaiming the town. It's creeping back in, and it's taking over the buildings and lifting the pavements and things like that. And that continues through all three books.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Especially with the global warming. And there were hints to it. And he says, "I could see it changing. The summers longer, the winters shorter, the storms came more regular, the warmer climate was making everyone sick." Was this to bring that issue to the forefront?
It was. And of course, you've got to be really careful about the way you're doing it, but you know, in any form of writing, I think, but particularly in YA, because the moment readers start to think that you're preaching to them, they will switch off. in this, you know, there's a couple of really major issues that I want to draw on in writing all three of the books, but I have to allow the characters to observe them and for those issues to bleed themselves out through the action and through the development of the characters. So, I did want to make a point about that, but I have to be very subtle and very careful about the way I do it.
I did see the subtlety in there, and it was funny because there's always a bit of a mystery when you read dystopian text about, oh, how did this world come about? And it's so much nicer when there are just hints to it, because you can then draw on your own imagination.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've been questioned quite a bit about, you know, tell me more about the virus. What was the virus and how did it eventuate and things like that? And I really didn't. Purposely, I didn't want to write a book about a virus that wipes out humanity. I wanted to write a book about these kids who are placed into this incredibly difficult situation. And it's really a character. They're all character-driven novels.
And it is true. The virus impacted women more than it did men, and as a result, the world became more dangerous and violent. And I remember reading China Inc. quite a while ago, and they've got the, you know, uneven ratio of men to women, and they feared that the world would then succumb to violence due to their frustration of never finding a bride or being worthy of having one. Do you think it's inevitable, if there's that female-male ratio, that the world would succumb to violence?
Not necessarily. And I think that what, you know, in writing these books, I wanted to confront the readers with the moral dilemma, basically. Mm-hmm. And obviously using the protagonist, Finn, you know, 16-year-old boy, as that sort of, if you like, a force for good, a boy who tries to hang on to his understanding of what's right and what's wrong. And to contrast that with the Wilders, who have gone the other road and who have taken advantage of the breakdown of law and order to, you know, exercise violence and to rule by violence.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because whenever the rules fall away, it seems to, the societal structures collapse. There seems to be this divide in societies. And, you know, you say in the book, all the rules fell away after the virus and I stopped trusting people a long time ago. So it's interesting that people become Finn and then other people become Ramage.
It is, isn't it? And look, it's all, obviously it's speculative, but I did want... The idea of it affecting the virus affecting women more than men was really to sort of place that that huge value on the lives of the two girls in particular, mm-hmm. In Rose and Kaz, and it sort of made sense, you know, that one of them would be pregnant and therefore was, you know, there's even greater value placed on her. That was the point of that. And again, it sort of sits in the background after that.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, Finn is constantly faced with moral choices, whether or not he helps the girl, whether he has the ability to kill people who have proven themselves evil. And he's surrounded by people who have no problem killing when it's necessary. And it was really important, as you say, for Finn to be the book's moral compass. I think it was really important, too, to have that opposing figure of Ramage.
Yeah, and... As the narrative develops and there are more grey areas that come into it, really, because it's not just the black and white of Finn taking one particular course and the Wilders taking another. In the middle there sit a lot of other people, the Nolanders, who are introduced mm-hmm. in the second book, and Kaz herself, you know. Kaz, who has had a very different history to what Finn has had, and that history informs her actions. So, you know, and I wanted that to be that's even a greater dilemma for Finn, because this is someone that he loves, but who is still capable of violence because of where she's come from.
Yeah, and it is kind of idealistic, isn't it, when he's living in this world of survival. But it's nice. I mean, you do need someone to be that moral compass, otherwise everyone kind of just goes out and does whatever they want.
You've got to have a thread like that to hold a book like this together. Mm-hmm. At times, you know, when I was writing it, this is told through the eyes of a 16-year-old boy, so he needed to be, I've mentioned this quite a number of times, as a 16-year-old, he needs to be consistently inconsistent. He makes really poor decisions, you know, but the one thing that he does seem to hold strong to is that moral direction, even when it's tested again and again and again. And whether he succumbs to that, you probably need to get into the third book to find out.
And you can see him growing, and even his empathy for Kaz continues to grow. And at the time of the book, when he becomes branded with the R, I feel like there's that constant parallel between him and Kaz, and they're getting this deeper understanding of each other.
Yeah, they come from different worlds, and it was probably equally noticeable with Rose when Rose first arrived in Angara. Two completely different young people coming from totally different situations. With Kaz, there's probably an inference that she hasn't had the sorts of abuses that her sister did, that her sister had protected her from some of those, so not quite as damaged as she was, but still damaged enough to present this different point of view to... And I mean, she struggles. Let's face it, Kaz struggles with Finn at times too, mm-hmm. you know, wondering how he can continue to exist in the way that he does, doing the things that he does and acting in the way that he does with that really strong moral compass, which sometimes she questions.
And you question as a reader too, because there were some points in the book where I'm like, oh, God, Finn, just do it.
I think you're alone in that.
I loved one of the first descriptions of Finn. So he says, it was like trying to talk with a mouthful of sand. I not only thought it was such a great description of the character and his struggles, but it's interesting that despite his inability to communicate well, he survived when so many others didn't.
Yeah, look, it was a couple of points, really. The first one was that even I wanted the reader to think that even when society was functioning previously, you know, prior to the virus, that he was a bit of an outsider, mm-hmm. That he had this sort of handicap that meant he couldn't communicate that well, but it meant he thrust himself into the environment as an escape. So hence his surfing, the rabbit trapping, those sorts of things. And it also, if you think right back to the beginning of the first book, I was very conscious of not wanting to dump backstory quickly, because I wanted the reader to get caught up in the action and carried with it. So that idea about Finn and the way that he's lived sort of bleeds out relatively slowly, mm-hmm. As opposed to Rose when she arrives and we hear everything about Rose at the beginning. So his inability to communicate effectively meant that I could sort of bleed that story out, as I said, a little more gently than the way Rose's story comes out.
And Kaz, with her birthmark, almost kind of mirrors Finn in that they're flawed in a way that mattered in their previous world, but just, you know, matters much less in this one. So what was your process of the development of Kaz? Did you mean them to be kind of these parallel characters who challenge each other but still find love together?
Yeah, I did. Through her experience with Finn, that she learns to trust and she learns to love. So there needed to be, other than the abuses that she's obviously had, you know, happen to her during her captivity, there needed to be something else as well which set her apart, living on the farm with Stan and Beth, that even then she was treated as different. And it was the birthmark which kind of gave her that point of difference. Mm-hmm. So when you're creating characters, you want your characters to be distinctive. But I think it also enabled, as you're right, it enabled a point of connection between Finn and Kaz that they eventually, you know, find themselves making.
And unfortunately for her, it made her unable to hide because they knew straight away who you were talking about.
That's right.
The birthmark.
Yes, yeah. The number of times that, you know, she even calls herself ugly at times, mm-hmm. you know, and that the Wilders always make reference to her being ugly, but Finn can't see that. He mm-hmm. doesn't see it. He just sees her for the person that she is.
And that was nice in such an ugly world. They found the beauty, or those things didn't matter anymore.
Yeah, and they kind of, you know, they kind of take the piss out of it a little bit too, which is good, you know, mm-hmm. like, when you know, Finn says something like, you know, you're the girl for me, or, you know, the only one for me, and she says, well, there's not that many to choose from anymore, are there? You know?
Is that Australian humour coming out, I think?
Yeah, and, you know, you sort of think about a dystopian, writing a dystopian book, and it can't be all dark and negative. There needs to be rays of hope. And also just in that, you know, that classic sort of rising action that you have in the narrative, there's got to be little respites in there as well, respites for the reader who can, you know, who maybe clue into that little bit of humour that finds its way in the interaction between these two kids.
And another important issue is one, you know, the comment on the asylum seekers. And Kaz says throughout the book, didn't you hear about the boats were being turned back and later they were sunk? Obviously, that is extremely relevant, important to us living in Australia. And then each Siley was chipped and sold as a slave. And it shows that both in the new and the old world, humanity just lacks such empathy. And Kaz says there's a danger in just being a girl these days. Worse still, if you're a Siley. And I thought, it's kind of even true in this world, which makes it even sadder.
Yeah, again, it's one of the great things you can do when you're writing a dystopian story is you can actually take an existing situation and ratchet it up two or three levels to the point of it almost being believable, you know. And when, you know, I've been asked questions, you know, do you actually think that could happen in Australia, you know, that Silas could be brought in from detention centres and sold as slaves? And my answer is always the same, and that is that, you know, 16 years ago I would never have believed that my country would be holding men, women and children in indefinite detention in offshore prison camps. So I would never have believed that 16 years ago. So who's to say at some stage in the future that it wouldn't escalate to that sort of level?
Who knows what the next 20 years holds? Yeah. So you're right.
And again, it's walking a fine line in covering issues like that. I think young adult readers are quite capable of dealing with those issues. But again, as soon as they sense that you're hitting them over the head with your beliefs, they're going to switch off from it. So you need everything we learn about the Sileys comes out through Rose and through Kaz. And my, you know, my very favourite, every author has a favourite part where they think, oh God, I nailed that really well there. And it's towards the end of the first book where you know, finally Kaz confronts Finn and says, you know, how could, even before the virus, you were so cruel, how could you do that, you know, speaking about his country. Mm-hmm. And Finn kind of, there's a word on the tip of his tongue and eventually he says, sorry, you know. And Kaz, being the person that she is, she says, it's okay, Finn, it's not your fault. It's never the kid's fault.
And that was part of the great empathy for Finn and Kaz and Willow, is the fact that they were kids. And Finn says, I want to say we're only kids and we shouldn't have to deal with this stuff. And yet they do.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you bring, you know, mention Willow as well, because Willow is a character that sort of sits on the periphery a bit of the first book, but really grows as a character in the second, and takes a, you know, a more major role. And I'm, you know, in the process of writing the third book at the moment, and again, it's when you're, I've kind of been thinking as I've been developing these books that these kids are actually, as you mentioned earlier, they're growing as well. Mm-hmm. They're growing with the reader. By the time the third book finishes, Finn will be, who began as a 16-year-old, will be closer to a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
So his understandings will have changed, his language changes, his relationships change, all of those things. He has all those greater understandings, particularly with the, you know, the horrific sorts of experiences he's been through. But it's how his resilience develops over those 3 years.
I actually find Willow a really interesting character.
You're going to love the third book then.
No, I find that she's really interesting because it's that really interesting age being brought into this dystopian, because you've got the baby, obviously, who will know nothing but the dystopian,
yeah,
and you've got Kaz, yeah, and Finn, who have quite a long period of time where they've not been in the dystopian. But it's interesting how Willow will develop, because she's right in the middle of that really impressionable age, and, you know, is she going to remember enough of the old world or not? So I think she's actually a really interesting character.
She begins as a 9-year-old, and I don't think that someone of that age is incapable of those sorts of actions or understandings. It's just that I don't think they can do it consistently. They are, as you say, they're informed by where they come from, and it's a very unsettled world that she's come from for as long as she can remember.
Mm, yeah, no, it's interesting. So we'll look forward to book three in that case. Now, I've heard some readers compare the novel to Marsden's Tomorrow When the War Began. I actually saw some parallels to McCormack's The Road. I thought, oh, this could be the kid grown up. What were your literary inspirations for these novels?
I definitely the John Marsden stuff, and I read those with my kids when they were growing up. And I think, you know, you've got to be, I almost shy away from reading other dystopian stuff because I don't want to be influenced by it. I don't, yeah, want it to sneak into my subconscious and sort of find its way into my writing. But certainly, yeah, the Cormac McCarthy reference, I mean, number one, I'm wrapped if people see anything. You know, I talk about John Marsden. John Marsden's 33 books ahead of me, you know, so I'm happy just to be mentioned in the same sentence as John Marsden. You know, like, most writers, I read incredibly widely and across all genres. So everything from crime to literary fiction to short stories to not so much romance, but and to YA as well. So it's hard, you know, my favourite book sort of changes every week. In terms of the style that I've written it in, I've been very strongly influenced by some Australian writers. And you can embellish that narrative, but make sure that it's in, you know, and writing in the language of a 16-year-old boy, which is a difficult thing in itself, but it's guaranteed to be also your prize.
How did you channel that 16-year-old?
It was actually one of the easiest things that I could do, because in my life outside of writing, I work solely with 15-year-old boys in an educational setting. So I have been there. I've been in that headspace for a long time. But I just think that they are the most underrated, undervalued. It is the most underrated, undervalued sort of age, particularly boys of that age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they are capable of incredible strength and incredible resilience as soon as adults step back and stop being strong and resilient for them and allow them to actually engage and learn from their mistakes. And so getting into that headspace wasn't difficult, but language was a little more difficult because, you know, I kept having these conversations with Finn where, you know, in my head where I'd be saying, God, I could write this so much better than you if I could just, you know, but it had to be in the language of a 16-year-old boy. So every time I came back to my desk to work on a manuscript, it was, It was, I had to write a 16-year-old Finn, not adult Mark. That was the thing that was probably the hardest.
That's interesting. Now, I work with teenagers as well, and I find that they just bring you so much joy, you know, out of the serious business of being an adult. They remind you that, hey, life can be fun and joyful.
Yeah, and they stuff up. They make mistakes. They break things. They, you know, Finn does time and time again where he makes some poor decisions, and it wouldn't be, he wouldn't be a 16-year-old boy if he didn't, you know. And that might be frustrating for the reader at times, but it's true to character.
Yeah, it's authentic for sure. So I saw that book three has been written or printed out, Land of Fences. Yeah. Can you tell us anything about the third book?
It is probably the best way of describing it is that the larger world begins, comes and impacts on these kids. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of been sitting in the background for the first two books. But there has to be some attempt for society to reestablish itself. And since it's the third and last book, it needs to draw together all of the threads that have been, you know, that have been left dangling in book one and book two, and through the narrative of book three as well. So, and that means, as I said, that larger world impacting on them, and then how they accommodate that.
And what's your writing process? So you're saying you've got to bring together all these threads, obviously, from the three books and bring them together. What is your writing process for a series? Did it mean to be a series? Was it always going to be a series, or did that develop along the way?
No, it very much developed along the way. Mm-hmm. And it was really along the lines of the first book being, you know, quite successful, and then obviously the publisher saying, well, you know, what's happening in the sequel? So it becomes a sequel, and then, well, what's happening in the third book of the trilogy? So very much I'm an absolute pantser in terms of sort of making up the narrative as I go along, mm-hmm. Which leaves you with very rough first drafts. And so then there's a lot of work required going back and sort of pulling it apart. And I don't tend to have really large structural edits because I've got the narrative okay. Mm-hmm. It's just in a lot of the detail. And I'm not a, you know, for someone who's putting out three books in 3 years, it's going to sound strange, but I'm not a disciplined writer. I really have to apply myself and switch off the modem and put my phone away and to find the time to write. But I'm lucky to be in a profession where, because I run a residential campus and I work a lot of 24-hour shifts, mm-hmm. So I have writing time when students go to bed, and I can fit it around my lifestyle fairly well.
Yeah. And so do you let the characters tell the story for you sometimes? Do they surprise you?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it's those conversations that you have with them sometimes. And I mean, the difficult thing is that when you're creating characters like that, you invest so much in them, and you come to love them and you want to protect them, but then you've got to do bad things to them. And that's a real... really, you know, it's a really hard thing to do. In each one of these books, there have been places that I found myself, when I've been writing certain scenes, I've been crying, you know, literally crying. So number one, I know, okay, well, I've got the emotion right, because if it's having this effect on me, it's likely to have this effect on the reader as well. But number two, it just sort of, it's like you want to protect your characters. And you know, one of the things that the editor came back after they got the manuscript for the second book was, you've got to hurt your characters more. You're too protective of them. So, you know, some of those bad things have got to happen to them. And a good example of that was, and it wasn't in the original manuscript, was the branding of Finn. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist. And that was one of the ways of demonstrating, well, he's got to, gives him an understanding of, you know, what's happening with the Sileys, but he needs to get hurt as well.
No, I found it really, really interesting, because it gave him much more empathy for Kaz. So I thought, well, now they're both outsiders and they're both owned by somebody. So I thought that was important. It's interesting. It didn't happen in the first manuscript, but it's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's what you pay an editor for. You know? They are fantastic. And the editor, Jane Pearson, from the second book, made the second book an infinitely better book than it was, by the work that she put into it.
And what was your publishing process? I always know that a lot of talent, bit of luck, lots of hard work. What was your experience?
I'm really reticent to sort of put it up as any sort of a typical experience, because it was totally atypical. I submitted to one publisher only. It went onto the slush pile. I knew nobody in the publishing industry. I'd had a lot of short stories published, so I had some experience there, so I knew I could write. Miraculously, this manuscript was picked off the slush pile of text, and I was, you know, immediately they wanted the rest of it. Within 2 weeks, I was in signing a 3-book deal with them. So it was so ridiculously make-believe, but it was like every writer's dream come true. I'm really reluctant to say that because I know I have a lot of friends who are writers and very, very talented writers who that step is just is so long and difficult for them. You mentioned the word luck, and I think a lot of it is just having the right manuscript in the right place at the right time. Now, from the time they received the manuscript, it was another 12 months before that book came out. And in the meantime, I started writing the second one so that we could get it out relatively quickly, another 12 months after that, to keep the interest there.
No, that's a really great story. You should be very proud of that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is quite just phenomenal, you know. And like I said, there is an element of luck to it, and I'm not being kind of self-deprecating by saying that. I really think there is, because I know there are so many talented writers out there who that sort of thing hasn't happened for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had a couple of students read it and absolutely loved it. So I think, you know, it is a story that really resonates with them and a story that needs to be told with so many important issues that, like you said, it's not hitting them over the head, but they're there if kids want to explore them. And it gives that extra layer of complexity to the novel. And it's there if they want to ask more questions or if they just want to keep going with the novel, they can. So you can read it in, you know, those multiple layers, which I think is really important.
Yeah, and my experience in actually writing it wasn't that different, because I first came up with the idea of writing it from talking to students that I work with, and I was actually showing them a DVD of Tomorrow When the War Began, and I said, oh, how many of you read this book? It's a great book, John Marsden, you know, and out of a class of 28, none of them put their hands up. So I started talking to them about their reading habits, and they simply don't have reading habits. And these are middle class boys, you know, they have access to books, but they are not readers. So I started to talk to them about, well, what would you like to see in a novel, if, you know, that would interest you? And I sort of built it around that, and largely around the voice of Finn. You know, that for me, that's what I wanted to carry the novel, was that voice.
That's great. I hope they read it.
It's compulsory now. It's on
the good. Yeah. So, I'm going to read it aloud for you boys.
Well, look, don't laugh at that, because that's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
I read the first two or three chapters aloud to them.
Yeah.
That gets them into the book, gets them into the action, and then, you know, we've got to look at why we lose boys in particular, and I know it's happening with girls as well, but the boys at a faster rate, why we lose them as fiction readers through their teenage years. And I think it's a pretty easy sort of rationalization to say, oh, it's technology, you know, but those reading habits have been declining for a long time. Yeah. And I really think it's, as an industry, it's something that we need to look at.
Absolutely. I find kids of any ages, they love to be read to. I teach high school, and it doesn't matter what age group they are, if you're reading something with enthusiasm, they love it.
Yeah. And it's, isn't it a pity though, that that's kind of associated, well, that's what you do in primary school, you know, but reading should be an enjoyable thing no matter what age. And if that means being read to, or we also make it a kind of a group thing that they can, it doesn't have to be a solitary pursuit reading. They can sit in a group of four or five off on their own somewhere and just take it in turns reading out aloud, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you make it more engaging in that way.
Yeah, those little reading circles. Yeah, whatever works, I reckon.
That's exactly right.
And young adult fiction has just exploded. So there's so much for them to read in so many different types of genres. So there's no excuse except for us to keep encouraging them to do that.
Yeah, I agree. Particularly, you know, Australian young adult fiction is just bursting at the seams with talent and a great diversity of books as well. I know we've still got to do more in terms of diversity, but it's happening here. I think it's showing the way, really, in industry in Australia.
Yeah, I think so too, actually. From the amount of authors I speak to, so many Australian, and it's kind of by accident, because I pick up a book and I find it interesting, and then I find out, oh, another Australian author. So that's been good as well. It's been a nice surprise.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's good that when Road to Winter was published in the US, we made a decision not to change the language for the US market. I was consulted about that, and I kind of took that Look, you know, do they change the language in an American book that sells over here for us? And they don't. So I just kind of think, well, why should we change? I was maybe a little bit parochial, but I felt quite strongly about it.
Yeah, I would agree. And I've spoken to a lot of American people and they really enjoy that kind of Australian colloquialism and slang and idioms. They enjoy that. So I think it's another level of experience for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today, Mark. I loved your books and I'm really looking forward to the third one. And like I said, my students have really enjoyed it as well. So it's been awesome to chat with you. What's next after the third book?
I'm not exactly sure. I've got some time off later in the year and I'm going to look at what I write then. And I mean, my 3-book deal is up, so I'll be out there and I'm pretty sure, I mean, Text has been such fantastic publishers for me and they've really looked after me. So hopefully I can interest them and we can keep that relationship going.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to more of your work. And again, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.